Hello and welcome to The Laydown, a podcast where three booksellers from Gibson's Bookstore in Concord, New Hampshire chat about all things literary. My name is Ryan.
I'm Hillary.
And I'm Kelso.
I'm Elizabeth.
Thanks for joining us, Elizabeth.
Hi.
She's our events coordinator. You've heard her here before. I'm really excited for today's episode. We are talking about audiobooks and Libre FM, and I'm thrilled because, as you all know, we love Libre FM, and we have partnered with them. We now have a special code. If you use the code LAYDOWN at checkout, you get three digital audiobooks for the price of one. So take advantage of that. So let's jump into it. Let's talk about what we're currently reading or listening to. Kelso, why don't you start?
Okay.
You've got a bunch.
The first one is called Continental Divide by Alex Myers. Alex Myers is a transgender man who works over at Phillips Exeter Academy and currently lives in New Hampshire.
Nice.
With his wife and two cats. He wrote this book about a newly transitioning trans man who goes out west from Boston to learn how to be, quote-unquote, a man. He goes out in the woods and he learns how to be this bootstrapper. It's very like trying to find yourself on this journey and trying to show everybody back in Boston that they are, in fact, a man and what it takes to be a man. It's a fabulous and well-written book. Alex was on The Bookshelf, which is NHPR's podcast about books, and he was amazing. And I wanted to support more local authors, and I wanted to read more diversely, so that's why I picked Continental Divide by Alex Myers. The second book I'm reading is a nonfiction book. It's called The Great Pretender.
She wrote Brain on Fire.
Yes. This book is about a very popular experiment that happened in 1973. A doctor convinced 8 healthy people to commit themselves to mental hospitals. And in order for them to get out, they had to prove their sanity. And their undercover mission would change the understanding of madness forever. This is a book about how the medical community kind of sees psychology and how psychologists, how can we explain that people are sane or insane?
Wow.
And it's very well researched, and she writes so well.
I've had my eye on that because I read Brain on Fire, and that book,
it was a scary book.
It's terrifying. Mm-hmm.
So all they did in this experiment was they gave them a fake background, but all they said was, everything was fine, but I'm hearing voices.
Nonviolent phrases, right? Like thud, and I hear a voice saying thud, not saying I want to kill all the puppies.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so like something super like neutral.
Something very neutral, and the way that they were treated was horrible. Oh. They were not mentally ill.
Right.
But they were treated atrociously.
Like they were.
And they couldn't get out, right?
Yeah.
It was
one person spent 53 days in a medical facility and trying to convince these people that he was sane.
New York, 1887. The young woman fixed her focus on the face, barely registering the wide, mournful eyes that stared back at her in the mirror. She smiled. She raged. She grimaced. She read aloud ghost stories until she spooked herself so thoroughly that she had to turn up the gaslight before she could return to the mirror. She practiced these hideous gazes until dawn, when she cleaned herself, put on an old moth-eaten dress, and tried to tamp down the growing uncertainty about what lay ahead. There was a chance she would never come home, or that even if she did, this assignment could change her forever. The strain of playing crazy, she wrote, might turn my own brain, and I would never get back. Despite her intense hunger, she skipped breakfast and headed to the temporary home for females on 2nd Avenue. This morning, she called herself Nellie Brown, though she had been born Elizabeth Jane Cochran, and as a professional journalist went by Nellie Bly. Her assignment, given to her by her editor at Joseph Pulitzer's New York World, was to infiltrate the notorious Women's Lunatic Asylum on Blackwell Island as a mental patient, to write a plain and unvarnished first-person narrative about the conditions there. In order to get inside the Blackwell Island Asylum, after all, she would need to prove that she was indeed insane. This was why she had forced herself to stay up all night, hoping that the physical strain of the sleep deprivation, combined with her disheveled appearance and wild eyes, might induce the house's matron to call the authorities to whisk Nellie off to an asylum, setting the whole plan in motion. When the U.S. government started tracking the incidence of mental illness, it broke it down into two broad categories of idiocy and insanity. By 1880, the census had expanded to include seven categories of mental disease: mania, melancholia, monomania, paresis, dementia, epilepsy, and dipsomania. But in the first half of the 19th century, most doctors believed that craziness was one size fits all, something called unitary psychosis. If you acted crazy, you were crazy.
So those are the books that I'm reading.
Okay, Elizabeth, what have you been reading or listening to recently?
Oh, gosh. I've got a couple books that I am in the middle of. Isn't that always the way?
Yes.
I'm reading an advanced reading copy of The Silvered Serpents by Roshani Choksi, which is the follow-up to The Gilded Wolves, which was sort of like a magical Victorian England Ocean's 11.
yeah, kind of.
Which was great, and that was a magical romp. This is The Silvered Serpents, which continues their adventures, and that's tremendous. I enjoy it very much. It has a tremendous amount of diversity in it, both ethnic diversity and skin color diversity, but also neurodiversity, and that's just tremendous fun. But the one that I am really, truly can't put down right now is I'm listening to The Body, A Guide for Occupants by Bill Bryson, which is so gross, and I can't stop listening to it.
She keeps telling us random facts.
it was disgusting. And the first day that I came in, and I was like, hey guys, did you know that castration is a preventative cure for baldness? Because DHT, which causes baldness, is a byproduct of testosterone. So all of those tropes of the bald eunuch are fake. That was, of course, my takeaway from day one. There was a section on lobotomies and the fascination society had with lobotomies when they discovered that severing or damaging the frontal lobe would have an effect on undesirable personalities. They found that if they had a violent, deranged person, they could perform a lobotomy and they would have a non-violent, deranged person. But it was performed willy-nilly. The doctors didn't really ask, oh, what's this person here for? You know, they did it on patients as young as four. They performed it on just people who were undesirable. They would pull in drunks. They would pull in travelers. They would just perform this, which is just horrifying, because they talked about Rosemary Kennedy, who, yes, had learning disorders and learning difficulties, and she had big mood swings, so you could argue that there was an aspect of mental illness, but largely she was a very vivacious and headstrong young woman in a very powerful and rich family, and they didn't like that anymore. So her father, without telling his wife, took her to get a lobotomy. She was this very popular, vivacious young woman. And then she was essentially left in a care home. And it was horrifying. Wow. Especially the medical way that they performed these lobotomies is they took an ice pick, not a surgical tool based on an ice pick, although that would eventually come later. They would insert it underneath the eyelid through to the back of the occipital bone. Punch through and stir, which is disgusting. And so, of course, I'm going to tell all of you about this. Fun things. It's absolutely fascinating. I'm learning so much about the body, and it's gross. But this is Bill Bryson, who has written very funny travelogues. He is a humor writer, and he is shifting over the last decade into, I mean, he's always written nonfiction, but this is informative nonfiction. He wrote a book called At Home, which takes you room by room through a house, the functions of a house, the way a house has changed, and just the minutia of history has been amazing. Yeah. So this is The Body. This is kind of like At Home. And he's funny. He'll throw in one-liners here and there. And the audiobook is actually read by the author.
I was going to ask, yeah. Oh, that's cool.
Which is pretty entertaining.
Long ago, when I was a junior high school student in America, I remember being taught by a biology teacher that all the chemicals that make up a human body could be bought in a hardware store for $5 or something like that. I don't recall the actual sum. It may have been $2.97 or $13.50, but it was certainly very little even in 1960s money. And I remember being astounded at the thought that you could make a slouched and pimply thing such as me for practically nothing. It was such a spectacularly humbling revelation that it has stayed with me all these years. The question is, was it true? Are we really worth so little? Many authorities, for which possibly read science undergraduates who don't have a date on a Friday, have tried at various times, mostly for purposes of amusement, to compute how much it would cost in materials to build a human. Perhaps the most respectable and comprehensive attempt of recent years was made by the Royal Society of Chemistry, when, as part of the 2013 Cambridge Science Festival, it calculated how much it would cost to assemble all the elements necessary to build the actor Benedict Cumberbatch. Cumberbatch was the guest director of the festival that year and was, conveniently, a typically sized human. Altogether, according to RSC calculations, 59 elements are needed to construct a human being. 6 of these, carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, calcium, and phosphorus, account for 99.1% of what makes us. But much of the rest is a bit unexpected. Who would have thought that we would be incomplete without some molybdenum inside us, or vanadium, manganese, tin, and copper? Our requirements for some of these, it must be said, are surpassingly modest and are measured in parts per million or even parts per billion. We need, for instance, just 20 atoms of cobalt and 30 of chromium for every 999,999,999½ atoms of everything else. The biggest component in any human, filling 61% of available space, is oxygen. It may seem a touch counterintuitive that we are almost two-thirds composed of an odorless gas. The reason we are not light and bouncy like a balloon is that the oxygen is mostly bound up with hydrogen, which accounts for another 10% of you, to make water. And water, as you will know, if you've ever tried to move a paddling pool or just walked around in really wet clothes, is surprisingly heavy. It is a little ironic that two of the lightest things in nature, oxygen and hydrogen, when combined, form one of the heaviest, but that's nature for you. Oxygen and hydrogen are also two of the cheaper elements within you. All your oxygen will set you back just £8.90, and your hydrogen a little over £16, assuming you are about the size of Benedict Cumberbatch. Your nitrogen, 2.6% of you, is better value still at just 27 pence for a body's worth. But after that, it gets pretty expensive. You need about 30 pounds of carbon, and that will cost you £44,300, according to the Royal Society of Chemistry. They were using only the most purified forms of everything. The RSC would not make a human with cheap stuff. Calcium, phosphorus, and potassium, though needed in much smaller amounts, would between them set you back a further £47,000. Most of the rest is even more expensive per unit of volume, but fortunately only needed in microscopic amounts. Thorium costs almost £2,000 per gram, but constitutes just 1/10,000,000th of a percent of you, so you can buy a body's worth for 21 pence. All the tin you require can be yours for 4p, while zirconium and niobium will cost you just 2p apiece. The 7/1,000,000th of 1% of you that is samarium isn't apparently worth charging for at all. It's logged in the RSC accounts as costing zero. Of the 59 elements found within us, 24 are traditionally known as essential elements, because we really cannot do without them. The rest are something of a mixed bag. Some are clearly beneficial, some may be beneficial, but we are not sure in what ways yet. Others are neither harmful nor beneficial, but are just along for the ride, as it were, and a few are just bad news altogether. Cadmium, for instance, is the 23rd most common element in the body, constituting 0.1% of your bulk, but it is seriously toxic. We have it in us not because our body craves it, but because it gets into plants from the soil and then into us when we eat the plants. If you live in North America, you probably ingest about 80 micrograms of cadmium a day, and no part of it does you any good at all.
Awesome. I'm currently listening to The 10,000 Doors of January, which was written by Alex E. Harrow, and is actually narrated by someone named January Lavoie, which I thought was fun because the main character's name is January. It's fantastic. It's a very fun fantasy that involves traveling through doors to other worlds. And it's funny, I picked this up because when this book came out, Erin Morgenstern tweeted about it and she called it the cousin to the Starless Sea. She was like, I love this book. It feels like they are kin and you should read it. And so I went, okay. And so I did, because I read whatever Erin tells me to read.
You follow Erin into battle.
I probably would, yes. It goes sort of back and forth in time, and there are a couple of stories that you are sort of like listening to one story and then it connects to the main plot, which is fun. And I love the idea of, like, you know, finding a door to another world. It's very Alice in Wonderland-esque, and it's really good, and the narrator is fantastic. I haven't sped it up. I usually listen at, you know, 1.75 or 2 speed, which I apologize to the audiobook narrators out there who all just cringed at that, but I like to crush audiobooks, so I listen to them at a very fast pace.
The 10,000 Doors, being a comparative study of passages, portals, and entryways in world mythology. This text was produced by Yule Ian Scholar for the University of the City of Nin in the years between 6908 and unknown, in partial satisfaction of his attainment of mastery. The following monograph concerns the permutations of a repeated motif in world mythologies, passages, portals, and entryways. Such a study might at first seem to suffer from those two cardinal sins of academia, frivolity and triviality, but it is the author's intention to demonstrate the significance of doorways as phenomenological realities. The potential contributions to other fields of study, gramology, glottology, and anthropology, are innumerable, but if the author may be so presumptive, this study intends to go far beyond the limitations of our present knowledge. Indeed, this research might reshape our collective understanding of the physical laws of the universe. The central contention is simply this: the passages, portals, and entryways common to all mythologies are rooted in physical anomalies that permit users to travel from one world to another. Or, to put it even more simply, these doors actually exist.
Hillary, what are you reading or listening to right now?
I have gone back and started re-listening to His Dark Materials.
I have been too. I've never read them, and they're fascinating. I've never read them.
Aren't they the best?
They are, well, so good.
So
this is delightful to see you guys. Is this your first time, or you've
gone back? I read these books as they came out. My kids, I believe, were too little then.
Now, yeah, they're really dark.
I have a 30-year-old and a 24-year-old, so you can...
They've
been around for a while. But I read them as they came out. I just feel like Philip Pullman is one of the most brilliant writers.
Yeah,
people
just hands
these
down.
These are kids' books.
No. Anyone can read these.
Anybody can read them. And I would also say they're more YA than...
Definitely. We have them. We actually, this is one of the only series that we have shelved in two different places in the store. We do have most of them in YA. It's usually the first really good, epic, dark fantasy that a teenager is ready for, right? We will give this to those middle schoolers who are reading at a higher level, mm-hmm. that because it's appropriate for them, but it's also dark and exciting. And mm-hmm. But we also have these books shelved in adult sci-fi fantasy because they are dark and they are, they're so well written. Mm-hmm. And a lot of adults will find them there and read them where they may not pick them up in YA, but you're like, no, everyone should read these. They're amazing.
I
read that for the first time, I think I was 11, and my friend gave it to me for my birthday. And the thing about this series, I adore this series, and the thing is, when I was a child, it was an adventure.
Yes.
It was an adventure about a talking polar bear and mm-hmm. a girl, and she was going to save this and that. And a lot of it went over my head, but there was an adventure for me to follow. And then I read it again as an adult, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is about original sin and the power mm-hmm. struggle between church and state. And it went way over my head before, and now yeah. there's this whole other layer of the story, which is really, you can appreciate it, and it's a different yeah. book at two ages.
I might say this is one of my qualifications for whether a book is a great piece of fantasy. Can you read it together with a child and an adult and both love it? And now Philip Pullman is writing further adventures in this series that's called The Book of Dust. Mm-hmm. And so the first one that came out maybe a year ago, La Belle Sauvage, is a prequel.
Okay.
You can do that without having done the trilogy mm-hmm. or listen to that one. And it is an excellent audio recording. Mm. Michael Sheen does the recording, and he is fantastic.
I love him.
Some distance from where the great colleges of Jordan, Gabriel, Balliol, and two dozen others contended for mastery in the boat races, out where the city was only a collection of towers and spires in the distance over the misty levels of Port Meadow, there stood the Priory of Godstow, where the gentle nuns went about their holy business. And on the opposite bank from the priory, there was an inn called the Trout. The inn was an old stone-built, rambling, comfortable sort of place. There was a terrace above the river, where peacocks, one called Norman and the other called Barry, stalked among the drinkers, helping themselves to snacks without the slightest hesitation, and occasionally lifting their heads to utter ferocious and meaningless screams. There was a saloon bar, where the gentry, if college scholars count as gentry, took their ale and smoked their pipes. There was a public bar, where watermen and farm labourers sat by the fire or played darts, or stood at the bar gossiping or arguing, or simply getting quietly drunk. There was a kitchen, where the landlord's wife cooked a great joint every day, with a complicated arrangement of wheels and chains turning a spit over an open fire. And there was a potboy called Malcolm Polstead. Malcolm was the landlord's son, an only child. He was 11 years old, with an inquisitive, kindly disposition, a stocky build, and ginger hair. He went to Ulvercott Elementary School, a mile away, and he had friends enough, but he was happiest on his own, playing with his demon, Aster, in their canoe, which was called La Belle Sauvage.
The Secret Commonwealth, which just came out, is actually a sequel. And in the original trilogy, His Dark Materials, Lyra's like 10, 11 years
yeah.
old.
Yeah.
She's now 21.
Oh, ooh.
In this one. They're just beautifully written. The first three feature a full cast, so there are multiple voice actors.
She felt those hands. It wasn't allowed. Not supposed to touch. Wrong.
Was she on her own?
A man was peering into the ceiling space.
Seems to be on her own.
Who is she?
It's the new child.
The one that's summoned at Hunters?
Yes.
You don't suppose she is a demon's...
Could well be. But not on her own, surely.
Should we tell...
I think that would put the seal on things, don't you?
I agree. Better she doesn't hear at all.
But what can we do about this?
She can't go back with the other children.
Impossible.
There's only one thing we can do, it seems to me.
No?
Have to. Can't leave it till the morning. She wants to watch.
We could do it ourselves. No need to involve anyone else.
The man who seemed to be in charge... The man who wasn't holding either Lyra or Pantalaimon tapped his teeth with a thumbnail. His eyes were never still. They flicked and slid and darted this way and that. Finally, he nodded.
No. Do it now,
he said.
Otherwise she'll talk. The shock will prevent that, at least. She won't remember who she is, what she saw, what she heard. Come on!
Lyra couldn't speak. She could hardly breathe. She had to let herself be carried through the station along white, empty corridors, past rooms humming with Anbaric power, past the dormitories where children slept with their demons on the pillow beside them, sharing their dreams. And every second of the way she watched Pantalaimon and he reached for her and their eyes never left each other. Then a door which opened by means of a large wheel. A hiss of air, and a brilliantly lit chamber with dazzling white tiles and stainless steel. The fear she felt was almost a physical pain. It was a physical pain as they pulled her and Pantalaimon over towards a large cage of pale silver mesh, above which a great pale silver blade hung poised to separate them forever and ever. She found a voice at last and screamed. The sound echoed loudly off the shiny surfaces, but the heavy door had hissed shut. She could scream and scream forever, and not a sound would escape. But Pantalaimon, in answer, had twisted free of those hateful hands. He was a lion, an eagle. He tore at them with vicious talons. Great wings beat wildly. And then he was a wolf, a bear, a polecat, darting, snarling, slashing, a succession of transformations too quick to register, and all the time bleeping, flying, dodging from one spot to another as their clumsy hands flailed and snatched at the empty air. But they had demons too, of course. It wasn't two against three, it was two against six. A badger, an owl, and a baboon were all just as intent to pin Pantalaimon down, and Lyra was crying to them.
Why? Why are you doing this? Help us! You shouldn't be helping them!
And she kicked and bit more passionately than ever, until the man holding her gasped and let go for a moment, and she was free, and Pantalaimon sprang towards her like a spark of lightning, and she clutched him to her fierce breast, and he dug his wildcat claws into her flesh, and every stab of pain was dear to her.
Never, never, never!
She cried, and backed against the wall to defend him to their death. But they fell on her again, three big, brutal men, and she was only a child, shocked and terrified. And they tore Pantalaimon away and threw her into one side of the cage of mesh and carried him, struggling still, around to the other. There was a mesh barrier between them, but he was still part of her. They were still joined. For a second or so more, he was still her own dear soul. Above the panting of the men, above her own sobs, above the high, wild howl of her demon, Lyra heard a humming sound and saw one man, bleeding from the nose, operate a bank of switches. The other two looked up and her eyes followed theirs. The great pale silver blade was rising slowly, catching the brilliant light. The last moment in her complete life was going to be the worst by far.
What is going on here?
A light, musical voice. Her voice. Everything stopped.
What are you doing? And who is this child?
She didn't complete the word child, because in that instant she recognized Lyra. Through tear-blurred eyes, Lyra saw her totter and clutch at a bench. Her face, so beautiful and composed, grew in a moment haggard and horror-struck.
Lyra...
The golden monkey darted from her side in a flash and tugged Pantalaimon out from the mesh cage as Lyra fell out herself. Pantalaimon pulled free of the monkey's solicitous paws and stumbled to Lyra's arms.
Never, never!
She breathed into his fur and he pressed his beating heart to hers. They clung together like survivors of a shipwreck, shivering on a desolate coast. Dimly she heard Mrs. Coulter speaking to the men, but she couldn't even interpret her tone of voice. And then they were leaving that hateful room, and Mrs. Coulter was half carrying, half supporting her along a corridor. And then there was a door, a bedroom, scent in the air, soft light. Mrs. Coulter laid her gently on the bed. Lyra's arm was so tight around Pantalaimon that she was trembling with the force of it. A tender hand stroked her head.
My dear, dear child, how ever did you come to be here?
Philip Pullman came up with the concept of the demon, D-A-E-M-O-N. In this world, every person has a demon, and that demon is another part of yourself, and that demon is some sort of an animal, and it's like different for every person.
An external part of your soul.
Yeah, it's like your soul on the outside.
It's like your soul, it's like your conscience, but it's also like a sibling or a spouse, or it's somebody deeply close to you that you can't be parted from, or it's just crushing.
It hurts,
and it hurts
to be away from
physically
them.
Hurts.
And like even like down the hall from each other, like they literally, like you are proximity close, and the children, their demons shift form.
Right, when you're a child, as your demon hasn't established its spinal shape yet,
and then eventually it settles.
And there are very few ideas in fantasy that are so compelling as this demon character. And if you read it, you're going to spend a lot of time obsessing about what your demon would be.
It's been years since I read them, and I still, on like a semi-regular basis, go, I wonder if that would be my demon. Oh, no, maybe that would be my demon. Oh, I bet this would be my demon. Like, I still think about it. There's a scene in book two that I literally have never gotten out of my head because it was written so beautifully. There's a character, and the character has a knife, and the character is holding the knife out into the air and moving it slowly around, and then they find a catch, in the air, and they pull the knife down and they slit the air and into another world. That moment, I read these books like a decade ago. That moment has never left my brain because the writing is so visceral. Like, I was there with that character. I felt it. I felt the way the knife caught on the empty air and sliced through the world. Like, oh, it's so good.
Yeah, it's about parallel universes,
yes,
basically.
Yes, yes.
But I also want to say, if you're listening to this with children, I would definitely recommend slightly older children.
Yeah.
There are very sad things that happen in these books.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, they're very dark.
And it's also a series that has been boycotted. Because it has some religious themes that
unflattering religious.
Yes.
And the show is fantastic.
Oh, and that is what inspired me to go back because I wanted to see what was going to be different in the HBO series.
Yes.
And they're doing a very good job, unlike the film, which was
Don't talk about the film. The film doesn't exist. no, they are, as of recording this right now, they are two episodes in, and it's beautiful. You can tell that the showrunners really love the material, and I'm just off to the side waiting for Lin-Manuel to show up as Lee Scoresby. It's fine.
Yes, that's very exciting.
It's fine.
As the aviator, the balloonist,
Lee Scoresby.
Someone on Twitter before the premiere, someone was like, Lin, when do you show up in the show? And he said, when Lyra needs me. And I just died right then and there. I just fell on the floor. Oh, I love him so much. That's actually a great segue for one of the books I wanted to talk about. Do you guys ever listen to audiobooks just because of who reads them?
Yes.
So I found out that Lin-Manuel Miranda, which if you've been listening to our podcast from the beginning, you know who he is. He created Hamilton. He narrated this book called Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe.
Oh, that's supposed to be fantastic.
It is beautiful. It is a beautiful story of friendship, of male friendship, of coming of age, of gender and sexuality and adventure. And I had never picked it up before, but then I got Libre FM and I was like, oh, Lin narrated a book? Neat. And I listened to it and it was gorgeous.
One summer night, I fell asleep hoping the world would be different when I woke. In the morning, when I opened my eyes, the world was the same. I threw off the sheets and lay there as the heat poured in through my open window. My hand reached for the dial on the radio. Alone was playing. Crap, Alone, a song by a group called Heart. Not my favorite song. Not my favorite group. Not my favorite topic. You don't know how long. I was 15. I was bored. I was miserable. As far as I was concerned, the sun could have melted the blue right off the sky. Then the sky could be as miserable as I was. The DJ was saying annoying, obvious things like, "It's summer, it's hot out there." And then he put on that retro Lone Ranger tune, something he liked to play every morning because he thought it was a hip way to wake up the world. Hi-yo, Silver! Who hired this guy? He was killing me. I think that as we listened to the William Tell Overture, we were supposed to be imagining the Lone Ranger and Tonto riding their horses through the desert. Maybe someone should have told that guy that we weren't all 10-year-olds anymore. Hi-yo, Silver! Crap. The DJ's voice was on the airwaves again. Wake up, El Paso! It's Monday, June 15th, 1987. 1987, can you believe it? And a big happy birthday goes out to Waylon Jennings, who's 50 years old today. Waylon Jennings? This was a rock station, dammit. But then he said something that hinted at the fact that he might have a brain. He told the story about how Waylon Jennings had survived the 1959 plane crash that killed Buddy Holly and Ritchie Valens. On that note, he put on the remake of La Bamba by Los Lobos. La Bamba. I could cope with that.
So I will definitely, like, listen to a book just because of who reads it, even if it's something that I normally wouldn't pick up. And I'm so glad that I picked this one up because it's fantastic. And the author, Benjamin Alire Sands, has, I believe he has a sequel in the works. And Lynn basically told him, he was like, oh, yeah, I'll read all of your books. I'll read whatever you want. And I was like, okay, good, cool. All right, neat. He also reads the annotations in the Hamilton, which is also highly recommended. Yeah, no, I love kind of following a narrator. I actually also just listened to Wanderers by Chuck Wendig.
Oh, wasn't that good? I loved
fantastic.
It.
Fantastic. Really, really fantastic. And the Dominic Hoffman narrated, he was one of, there were two narrators, but Dominic Hoffman specifically narrated part of it. And when I went to listen to The Starless Sea by Aaron Morgenstern, it started and I said, wait, I know that voice. I know this. Who is this? And it was Dominic Hoffman. And I was so excited because I had just finished Wanderers. And I was like, oh, I feel like I'm sitting with like a friend who's just reading me stories because it's the same person.
There is a pirate in the basement. The pirate is a metaphor, but also still a person. The basement could rightly be considered a dungeon. The pirate was placed here for numerous acts of a piratey nature, considered criminal enough for punishment by those non-pirates who decide such things. Someone said to throw away the key, but the key rests on a tarnished ring on a hook that hangs on the wall nearby. Close enough to see from behind the bars, freedom kept in sight but out of reach, left as a reminder to the prisoner. No one remembers that now on the key side of the bars, the careful psychological design forgotten, distilled into habit and convenience. The pirate realizes this, but withholds comment. The guard sits in a chair by the door and reads crime serials on faded paper, wishing he were an idealized, fictional version of himself, wondering if the difference between pirates and thieves is a matter of boats and hats. After a time, he is replaced by another guard. The pirate cannot discern the precise schedule, as the basement dungeon has no clocks to mark the time, and the sound of the waves on the shore beyond the stone walls muffles the morning chimes, the evening merriment. This guard is shorter and does not read. He wishes to be no one but himself. He lacks the imagination to conjure alter egos, even the imagination to empathize with the man behind the bars, the only other soul in the room beyond the mice. He pays elaborate amounts of attention to his shoes when he is not asleep. He is usually asleep. Approximately 3 hours after the short guard replaces the reading guard, a girl comes. The girl brings a plate of bread and a bowl of water and sets them outside the pirate's cell with hands shaking so badly that half the water spills. Then she turns and scampers up the stairs. The second night, the pirate guesses it is night, the pirate stands as close to the bars as he can and stares, and the girl drops the bread nearly out of reach and spills the bowl of water almost entirely. The third night, the pirate stays in the shadows of the back corner and manages to keep most of his water. The fourth night, a different girl comes. This girl does not wake the guard. Her feet fall more softly on the stones, and any sound they make is stolen away by the waves or by the mice. This girl stares into the shadows at the barely visible pirate, gives a little disappointed sigh, and places the bread and bowl by the bars. Then she waits. The pirate remains in the shadows. After several minutes of silence, punctuated by the guards snoring, the girl turns away and leaves. When the pirate retrieves his meal, he finds the water has been mixed with wine. The next night, the fifth night, if it is night at all, the pirate waits by the bars for the girl to descend on her silent feet. Her steps halt only briefly when she sees him. The pirate stares, and the girl stares back. He holds out a hand for his bowl and his bread, but the girl places them on the ground instead, her eyes never leaving his, not allowing so much as the hem of her gown to drift into his reach. Bold, yet coy. She gives him a hint of a bow as she returns to her feet, a gentle nod of her head, a movement that reminds him of the beginning of the dance. Even a pirate can recognize the beginning of a dance. The next night, the pirate stays back from the bars, a polite distance that could be closed in a single step, and the girl comes a breath closer. Another night, and the dance continues. A step closer, a step back, a movement to the side. The next night, he holds out his hand again to accept what she offers, and this time she responds, and his fingers brush against the back of her hand. The girl begins to linger, staying longer each night, though if the guard stirs to the point of waking, she departs without a backward glance. She brings two bowls of wine, and they drink together in companionable silence. The guard has stopped snoring, his sleep deep and restful. The pirate suspects the girl has something to do with that. Bold and coy and clever. Some nights, she brings more than bread. Oranges and plums secreted in the pockets of her gown. Pieces of candied ginger wrapped in paper laced with stories.
So that was fun, and it kind of made me want to look at other things he's read, because now I'm, like, familiar with his voice.
And did you know Davy Diggs is narrating The Deep?
Oh, my God.
The new book by River Solomon and others. I think he actually participated in writing the book, but talking of Hamilton.
Another Hamilton alum.
It was like dreaming, said Yetu, throat raw. She'd been weeping for days, lost in a remembering of one of the first Wajinru. Then wake up, Amaba said, and wake up now. What kind of dream makes someone lurk in shark-dense waters, leaking blood like a fool? If I had not come for you, if I had not found you in time. Amaba shook her head, black water sloshing over her face. Do you wish for death? Is that why you do this? You are grown now, have been grown. You must put those childish whims behind you.
God, this is just going to be the episode where Ryan fangirls over and over again. Hillary, you brought up a good point where there's a big difference between a full cast audiobook and a single narrator or a couple of narrators. And I used to have very strong feelings about this because a long, long time ago, I listened to a very strange recording of The Lord of the Rings that was full cast, but it was almost a radio play. Like, it was less audiobook, more every single character had a different narrator. It was not great. Apologies if you're a fan of that particular audiobook. I was not. And so for a long time, I was very, like, anti-full cast. Like, I would see full cast recording and be like, no. But I don't know. I'm kind of getting to a place where I'm reading books or I'm listening to books where there are multiple perspectives. There are multiple stories happening. And in the audiobook, they have different narrators for each perspective. And that I find really cool. Like, that I'm enjoying, having, like, different perspectives, because they still will, it'll be one person who will do multiple voices, but each sort of, like, section will have their own narrator. So, like, when I read, I think it was Girl on the Train, had three female narrators because there were three women's stories. Mm-hmm. And so I always knew whose story I was in based on who was talking. I've lightened up a little bit on the full cast.
I do think there's something awe-inspiring about these people who can do so many different voices.
Yeah.
A case in point, I think, is Harry Potter.
Yes.
And a lot of people will have a disagreement about whether the American narrator or the British narrator, which one is better?
Do Stephen Fry or do you do
Jim Dale?
I'm a Jim Dale purist.
I love Jim Dale.
I'm a Jim Dale.
But my daughter prefers Stephen Fry.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so I had both, but not the full series of both. I did have the full series of Jim Dale, and then I had, I think, two books with Stephen Fry. And it was very jarring one day when I finished one book and went to the next one. It was Stephen Fry instead of Jim Dale. I had, like, a mental breakdown. But I liked Stephen Fry. He did a great job. And I like Stephen Fry just in general. I think he's great. So it took a little getting used to because I had been listening to Jim Dale. But I liked him. But then you come back to Jim Dale and it's like coming home.
Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of No. 4 Privet Drive were proud to say they were perfectly normal, thank you very much. They were the last people you'd expect to be involved in anything strange or mysterious, because they just didn't hold with such nonsense. Mr. Dursley was the director of a firm called Grunnings, which made drills. He was a big, beefy man with hardly any neck, although he did have a very large moustache. Mrs. Dursley was thin and blonde and had nearly twice the usual amount of neck, which came in very useful as she spent so much of her time craning over garden fences, spying on the neighbours. The Dursleys had a small son called Dudley, and in their opinion there was no finer boy anywhere. The Dursleys had everything they wanted, but they also had a secret, and their greatest fear was that somebody would discover it. They didn't think they could bear it if anyone found out about the Potters. Mrs. Potter was Mrs. Dursley's sister, but they hadn't met for several years. In fact, Mrs. Dursley pretended she didn't have a sister, because her sister and her good-for-nothing husband were as un-Dursley-ish as it was possible to be. The Dursleys shuddered to think what the neighbours would say if the Potters arrived in the street. The Dursleys knew that the Potters had a small son too, but they had never even seen him. This boy was another good reason for keeping the Potters away. They didn't want Dudley mixing with a child like that. When Mr. and Mrs. Dursley woke up on the dull grey Tuesday our story starts, there was nothing about the cloudy sky outside to suggest that strange and mysterious things would soon be happening all over the country. Mr. Dursley hummed as he picked out his most boring tie for work, and Mrs. Dursley gossiped away happily as she wrestled a screaming Dudley into his high chair. None of them noticed a large, tawny owl flutter past the window.
Where do you guys listen to your audiobooks? Because I'm sure we have people who listen to us who are like, I've never done an audiobook before. I don't know how to get started. I don't know. I don't pay attention when I listen to things. My brain wanders. Elizabeth, where do you listen to audiobooks?
So, gosh, most of the time I have a couple places that I listen to mine. I have small children at home, so I can't actually do chores around the house listening to audiobooks because I need to be able to hear if they've lit the house on fire.
Legit.
I do have a lot of friends who say that they listen to audiobooks while they do chores. I listen two places. I listen at the gym. Mm-hmm. Which I've learned that I can't listen to music when I'm trying to do cardio because I try and match the beat of the music and then I run too fast and then I can't keep up and then I have to poop out of my whole cardio and it's a disaster.
Yep.
But an audiobook distracts me from the eternal purgatory of cardio.
Yes.
And I get at least 30, 35 minutes of an audiobook while I'm on an elliptical or taking a jog, and I also listen in the car. On rare occasions, I pop in earphones and I'll listen while I knit on the couch late at night, but physically it's mostly in the car, although again, small children, and they did pipe up from the back seat asking me what certain words meant, so I've had to be very careful after the, Mommy, what does bastard mean from the backseat? So it depends on the books. I mean, yeah. The body book that I'm listening to, they can listen to that, and they'll be like, I didn't know you could do that with an eyeball, which has its own concerns, honestly. But it mostly the gym, honestly. Yeah. The gym and the car, especially. I hate wasted time, which yes. We could have a whole conversation about the current obsession with efficiency, but I actually don't mind getting stuck in traffic now if I have an audiobook.
Yeah.
Because that extra 15 minutes gets me an extra half a chapter.
Exactly. It feels like progress.
Yes.
Yeah. What about you, Kelso? Where do you listen?
It's all the usual suspects, really. I listen mostly in the car. I have about a 30-minute commute, depending on the weather and the traffic.
Yeah.
The other times when I listen to audiobooks are when I have to vacuum. I have an issue with very loud sounds. I can't process it very well. I don't like listening to vacuum.
Yeah,
like fair. When we vacuum after work here, I have to pop in headphones in order to vacuum. And that's usually when I listen to stuff is like I'm vacuuming or I'm doing laundry or I'm doing chores. The other thing that I do very often is I listen to it at night. The reason why I listen to it like about a half hour before I go to bed is because if I start reading a half hour before bed, it is 10 minutes later and it's 3 o'clock in the morning. And
yes.
Because I don't have the off switch when I read a book.
Yep.
When I listen to audiobooks, I still don't have the off switch, but at the very least, Libro.fm has the...
they have the sleep timer.
The sleep timer.
So you can be like, in 10 minutes, turn off.
Yeah. So I use the sleep timer, and as soon as it turns off, it's done. I don't pick it up. It's a lights out.
Nice.
So that's usually when I listen to most of the books, too.
Yeah. What about you, Hillary?
Oh, my husband would tell you I never stop.
Oh, I love that.
I listen obsessively. If I'm not listening to a book, I'm listening to a podcast. And so he started getting really irritating because I would just play them. And so I began putting in earphones, and now he talks to me, and I'm like, what? What? Even more irritating.
Oh, no.
But when I'm not in the bookstore, I do a lot of physical stuff. I have a really big garden. I do a lot of cooking. I also do a lot of my own house maintenance, like painting and things like that. I also, you know, run, and I have a dog that I have to walk. So I am listening constantly.
Just all the time.
And some books I do definitely, you know, because we get to listen to these Libro FM preview books, very often, you know, if it's sort of just like your standard mystery, I will put it on 1.5 or 1.25 or something like that. But when it's something like Philip Pullman or good Terry Pratchett, I have all these Terry Pratchetts in my collection, and I listen to them over and over again because they make me happy and cheer me up, and they're hilarious and smart. I listen all the time. I will listen in the shower, you know, and I listen in the car.
Yep.
I go everywhere. Through multiples a week.
I listen mostly in the car because I have a very long commute. Mm-hmm. On a good day, it's 45 minutes. On an average day, it's an hour. So I crush audiobooks
in the car. Occasionally, I'll listen at home, but usually I save it for the car. And yeah, it's interesting. I get a lot of people asking how they're like, well, I zone out and I miss stuff. And I think for me, it was just a matter of just kind of practicing, I guess, listening to audiobooks. So like I started with, you know, you might start with something that maybe you've read before and you're rereading. Right? You're listening to something that you read years and years ago. So if you zone out, it doesn't matter because you know what happens. Or something that you like kind of want to read, but you're not like super invested in, right? Like you start there and you kind of practice focusing on the book. And it also, I have found that the skill of figuring out what's going on from context clues has gotten so much better since listening to audiobooks, because I will find that, like, you know, I zoned out for like 5 minutes, and then I'll tune back in and be like, okay, wait, I definitely missed something, hang on. And I'll like listen and be like, oh, okay, all right, that character slapped that other character, okay, cool, we're back. Like, but yeah, I don't know if you guys have like tips for people who have never listened to audiobooks before and they're like intimidated.
One of the first things that I learned when I was back in library school is I had been pre-warned that listening to the audiobook is an active skill that must be learned. It's a skill that you have to have at least half an ear on it. And honestly, the first one or two audiobooks you listen to, you might not remember. And that's super common. So maybe start with something short to start with first. But it's very common to be frustrated with the first one or two audiobooks because you've missed it and you're confused. It's a skill. It's a skill that you learn, and then it's like a bicycle. Once you've learned it, you can kind of climb back up.
I would also recommend, too, and this might sound counterintuitive, that there are often books like George Eliot's Middlemarch or a Charles Dickens novel, one of those big fat things, that are actually easier to listen to than yes. they are to read.
Yes. Oh, 100%. Some of the first audiobooks I ever listened to were books that, say, like my book club or something was reading that I just didn't really want to read. Yeah. It was either outside of my genre or it was too long or I like started reading it and it couldn't hold my interest. So I did the audiobook of it. And actually found it easier to listen to because it felt like someone was just telling me the story. And I was just right. like, oh, that's interesting. I listened to...
a great voice actor.
Yeah.
And it really makes a difference.
Yeah.
A beat poet. I was listening to Ibi Zoboi's
yes.
Pride, which yes. is a modern New York Black Pride and Prejudice. And it mm-hmm. was read by Elizabeth Acevedo, who's yep. an award-winning beat poet. And the rhythm at which she spoke the mm. book, it... hold you in. Yep. And honestly, I feel like if you listen to a verse novel, it might be a really great first book because poetry is meant to be spoken. I yes. mean, you can see it on the page, but hearing it performed, not even just read, but performed, adds whole new dimensions.
Absolutely.
It's a truth universally acknowledged that when rich people move into the hood, where it's a little bit broken and a little bit forgotten, the first thing they want to do is clean it up. But it's not just the junky stuff they'll get rid of. People can be thrown away too, like last night's trash left out on sidewalks or pushed to the edge of wherever all broken things go. What those rich people don't always know is that broken and forgotten neighborhoods were first built out of love. The new owners are moving into the mini mansion across the street today. For the last few months, construction crews have been giving that abandoned house an extreme makeover, Bushwick edition. They gutted and renovated the best thing on our block, that run-down, weed-infested, boarded-up house. Now it looks like something that belongs in the suburbs, with its wide double doors, sparkling windows, and tiny manicured lawn. I pull back the curtains to greet my little corner of Bushwick and Jefferson Avenues. My very own way of stretching out my arms and yawning at the morning sun. This is where I see words swim in and around my neighborhood, like dust from overhead train tracks. It's all poetry. So I pull those words together and try to make sense of it all. My hood, my Brooklyn, my life, my world, and me in it.
If any of our listeners have never listened to audiobooks before, they want to give it a shot, but they're nervous. It can be daunting because audiobooks can be expensive, right? If you're buying them one-off, they can be sometimes often more than the cost of the hardcover. However, if you use our code LAYDOWN, you're going to get two free ones. So I would say do that and use the two free ones on something that you're like, these are going to be my practice books. It's $14.99 for three. And it's going to be okay if you zone out. With LibroFM, you do own the audiobooks forever.
They're so DRM-free.
They are, so...
You're not renting it.
Yeah, they are yours forever. The digital file is yours forever, so you can always go back and listen again.
You do. Once you have them in your library, you will definitely find yourself going back and re-listening to them.
Absolutely. Before we wrap up, do we have a favorite audiobook we want to recommend? Do you have like one that you're like, ooh, you should listen to this?
Oh.
Or 10, it's up to you.
I really loved City of Brass, which
was great.
I have mentioned before, and that is about a con woman in Napoleonic Cairo who finds out that she's actually half genie when she accidentally summons a ghoul. And it is not, I mean, it is a fantasy, but it's really a book about the politics of a djinn city. And it was great, but the narrator was astonishing.
He was an easy mark. Nahri smiled behind her veil, watching the two men bicker as they approached her stall. The younger one glanced anxiously down the alley, while the older man, her client, sweated in the cool dawn air. Save for the men, the alley was empty. Fajra had already been called, and anyone devout enough for public prayer, not that there were many in her neighborhood, was already ensconced in the small mosque at the end of the street. She fought a yawn. Nahri was not one for dawn prayer, but her client had chosen the early hour and paid handsomely for discretion. She studied the men as they approached, noting their light features and the cut of their expensive coats. Turks, she suspected. The eldest might even be a Basha, one of the few who hadn't fled Cairo when the Franks invaded. She crossed her arms over her black abaya, growing intrigued. She didn't have many Turkish clients. They were too snobbish. Indeed, when the Franks and Turks weren't fighting over Egypt, the only thing they seemed to agree on was that the Egyptians couldn't govern it themselves. God forbid. It's not as though the Egyptians were the inheritors of a great civilization whose mighty monuments still littered the land. Oh, no. They were peasants, superstitious fools who ate too many beans. Well, this superstitious fool is about to swindle you for all you're worth, so insult away. Nari smiled as the men approached. She greeted them warmly and ushered them into her tiny stall, serving the elder a bitter tea made from crushed fenugreek seeds and coarsely chopped mint. He drank it quickly, but Nahari took her time reading the leaves, murmuring and singing in her native tongue, a language the men most certainly wouldn't know, a language not even she had a name for. The longer she took, the more desperate he would be, the more gullible. Her stall was hot, the air trapped by the dark scarves she hung on the walls to protect her client's privacy, and thick with the odors of burnt cedar, sweat, and the cheap yellow wax she passed off as frankincense. Her client nervously kneaded the hem of his coat, perspiration pouring down his ruddy face and dampening the embroidered collar. The younger man scowled. "This is foolish, brother," he whispered in Turkish. "The doctor said there's nothing wrong with you." Nari hid a triumphant smile. So they were Turks.
What about you, Kelso? Do you have one you'd like to recommend?
So the one that I really enjoy and I really highly recommend to people is On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous by Ocean Vuong.
Oh, yes.
Let me begin again. Dear Ma, I am writing to reach you, even if each word I put down is one word further from where you are. I am writing to go back to the time at the rest stop in Virginia when you stared, horror-struck, at the taxidermy buck hung over the soda machine by the restrooms, its antlers shadowing your face. In the car, you kept shaking your head. I don't understand why they would do that. Can't they see it's a corpse? A corpse should go away, not get stuck forever like that. I think now of that buck, how you stared into its black glass eyes and saw your reflection, your whole body warped in that lifeless mirror. How it was not the grotesque mounting of a decapitated animal that shook you, but that the taxidermy embodied a death that won't finish. A death that keeps dying as we walked past it to relieve ourselves. I'm writing because they told me to never start a sentence with because. But I wasn't trying to make a sentence. I was trying to break free. Because freedom, I am told, is nothing but the distance between the hunter and its prey.
Hillary, what would you recommend for an audiobook?
If you want something fun, I am going to recommend, there's a whole series of these books by Ben Aronovich that
yes.
are called the Rivers of London series.
You've been recommending these to me for years, and I haven't gotten to them yet.
They are so much fun. They are basically, they begin, the very first one is, there is a mixed race guy who has become a cop in London, and he's out for his first night, you know, or early in his career. And someone comes along and begins talking to him and then vanishes again. And it turns out he was talking to a ghost. And it turns out that he is one of very few people who have this ability to see the young, you know, what you're not supposed to see.
Oh my God.
And it turns out that there is this whole part of British law enforcement that's like MI5 and MI6, mm-hmm. but it's just for the supernatural.
Oh,
and
that's
so
awesome.
He gets pulled in to become, to train.
And
the part about the rivers of London is that every river in London, and there are many, and many of them are just trickles now, or they're buried under whatever, they have a god that personifies them. And so they're very funny. I would recommend those for some fun.
It's hard to describe what success felt like. Even before I managed to produce my first spell, I slowly became aware that I was getting closer, like a car engine turning over on a cold morning. I could sense something catching on my thoughts. An hour into my practice, I stopped and took a deep breath and opened my hand. There it was. The size of a golf ball and as brilliant as the morning sun, a globe of light. That's when I found out why Nightingale insisted I keep a sink filled with water nearby while I did the exercise. Unlike his globe of light, mine was yellow and giving off heat, loads of heat. I yelled as my palm burned and stuck my hand in the sink. The globe sputtered and went out. "You burned your hand, didn't you?" said Nightingale. Hadn't heard him come in. I pulled my hand out of the water and had a look. There was a pinkish patch on my palm, but it didn't look serious. "I did it," I said. "I couldn't believe it. I'd done real magic. It wasn't some stage trick by Nightingale." "Do it again," he said. This time, I held my hand directly over the sink, formed the key in my mind, and opened my hand. Nothing happened. "Don't think about the pain," said Nightingale. "Find the key and do it again." I looked for the key, felt the engine turn over, and opened my hand to release the clutch. It burned me again, but it definitely wasn't as hot, and my hand was much closer to the water. Still, I checked my palm. This time, it was going to blister for sure. "And again," said Nightingale, "reduce the heat, keep the light." I was surprised how easy I found it to obey. Key, power, release, more light, less heat. Warmth this time, not heat, and a yellow tone like an old 40-watt light bulb. Nightingale didn't have to tell me again. I opened my palm and produced a perfect globe of light. "Now hold it," said Nightingale. It was like balancing a rake on your palm. The theory's simple, but the practice lasts 5 seconds, tops. My beautiful globe popped like a soap bubble.
"Good," said Nightingale. "I'm going to give you a word. I want you to say this word every time you do the spell. It's very important that the spell's effect is consistent."
"Why is that?"
"I'll explain why in a minute," said Nightingale. "The word is lux."
I did the spell again. Key, motor. I spoke the word on the release. The globe sustained for longer. It was definitely getting easier.
"I want you to practice this spell," said Nightingale, "and just this spell for at least another week. You'll have the urge to experiment, to make it brighter, to move it around."
"You can move it around?"
Nightingale sighed. "Not for the next week."
I could recommend so many audiobooks. Yeah. I love audiobooks. I'm going to be very on brand. I'm going to recommend The Starless Sea by Erin Morgenstern.
I just downloaded that from
It's
Libra.
Beautiful. And as I said earlier, I love the narrator, Dominic Hoffman. He does a fantastic job. It is a gorgeous book. It is a love letter to stories. And in January, Erin Morgenstern will be on our podcast. Mm-hmm. And she will also be in the bookstore, and I will be interviewing her during her event on January 26th at 2 o'clock.
I wish you could see Ryan. She's hovering off the ground.
For those of you who don't remember, I had a Night Circus wedding. Erin Morgenstern wrote the Night Circus. And it's fine. I'm fine. Everything's fine. It's great. I'm great. I'm doing fine. No, it's a beautiful book. It's a beautiful audiobook. And you should all come to our event in January and make sure you listen to our episode with Erin Morgenstern in January. Or possibly February she'll be on the podcast because we record ahead of time. Speaking of events, we're almost done for the year, but we do have one left.
Mitch album is coming in December.
It's a biggie.
We're ending the year with a bang.
December 16th at 7 o'clock over at the Capital Center for the Arts. Mitch album will be presenting Finding Chica. I believe tickets are available for that now. Go to our website and get your tickets. It's going to be an amazing event. We're very excited. Does anybody have anything else they want to add before we wrap up?
We have a book club coming up. Yep. Is it December 2nd,
Kelso? It is December 2nd. Monday, December 2nd.
We are reading 5:30. Cold Comfort Farm, written by Stella Gibbons. Come to our book club.
Come
it's
to
getting
book
bigger
club.
And bigger. We keep running out of chairs.
That's
and
good.
Pizza.
We got to order more pizza. Awesome. Okay, one last time. Our listeners can receive 3 digital audiobooks for the price of 1 credit from Libre.fm by using the code LAYDOWN at checkout. Please, please use that deal. It's an amazing deal. If you want to try out audiobooks, we have a listening station in the store at the main register. We've got an iPad. We've got some audiobooks downloaded onto it. And we have some headphones. You can come give it a shot. See if you like it. You can email us about the podcast at thelaydownpodcast@gmail.com. Our website is gibsonsbookstore.com, and we're also on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and we'll put those links in the show notes along with all of the books we talked about today. Elizabeth, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you all so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll know when we upload our next episode, and consider leaving us a nice review. Until next time, we'll see you in the stacks.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.